Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Beirut, Lebanon and speak with Thanasis Kambanis, who writes the internationalist columns for the Boston Globe and is the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. We'll discuss Israel's assassination of a notorious Hezbollah militant by four missiles that struck a residential building just outside of Damascus in Syria, and examine the possible fallout as well as its effects on the outlines of a Syrian peace deal announced by the UN Security Council that has the support of both the US and Russia. Then we will speak with John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. We will discuss last night's Democratic presidential candidates' debate and try to understand why the DNC is trying to make sure as few Americans as possible watch the Democratic debates while the Republican debates are getting record ratings. And given the nature of what the Republicans are espousing, it would seem like an important moment for the Democrats to offer a counter-narrative. Then finally, since much of the debate was about the self-declared Islamic State, or ISIL, and how best to combat it, we will speak with Michael Brenner, a professor of international relations at the University of Pittsburgh and a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. We will discuss his latest article at the Huffington Post, Getting Real, an ISIL Strategy, and assess why a few thousand Mad Max-like desert marauders in pickup trucks waving black flags are able to terrify the American people and dominate our political discourse. And joining us now is Lebanese-based journalist Thanasis Kambanis, who writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and is a fellow at the Century Foundation. And his books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his latest book, Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasis Kambanis. Thanasis, are you there? I see. We don't have him yet? Oh. Okay. I think we're just trying to get through to Beirut right now, and he should be with us. Thanasis, are you there? Thanasis?
I'm with you.
Oh, there we go.
I'm in trouble.
Okay. So the assassination that just took place outside of Beirut, where a residential building was struck by four missiles. Israel hasn't claimed credit for it, but it's pretty clear that they're behind it, right? There's not much doubt. The target was
right. I mean, this is a strike where the target has been on top of Israel's most hated list ever since they were forced to release him in 2008, and it's also the kind of strike that really no other military power in the region has the literal power to pull off. I mean, the United States theoretically could have done it, but it requires a level of expertise that only Israel has.
Right. And these were probably JDAMs, right, that hit the building. Not too many people have them. So tell us about Samir Kuntar. You've met him, right?
I met Samir Kuntar when I was researching my book about Hezbollah. He was one of the most famous prisoners in the region. He was arrested in 1979 when he went on a mission where he snuck across the border to Israel on a boat and ended up murdering. He ended up attacking a residential neighborhood and murdering a civilian guy. The kids, one of the guy's kids actually was suffocated to death while hiding from the attack. So he was more so than most people who were caught by Israel, was really detested because his attack had, certainly in Israel's point of view, no military value at all. Later on, Hezbollah adopted him as a cause celebre and vowed to force his release from Israel's prisons. And that was one of the driving causes of the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah. Hezbollah had for many years made it a priority to capture either the bodies or living Israeli soldiers to trade them for the release of Samir Kuntar, and they achieved that. in the follow-up of the 2006 war. And that was something that really galled Israel and was a sort of humiliating reversal when Israel was forced to release this guy who was sort of, you know, reviled as a child killer. And on the other side, over here, he was looked at as a sort of brave child soldier who would sacrifice his liberty trying to fight against Israel. And when he was released, he became a really polarizing symbol for Hezbollah's idea of the resistance. And I mean, think about it. This guy was 16 when he conducted this pretty low-tech murderous attack. And when he was traded back to Lebanon, he was celebrated. He was trotted out by Hassan Nasrallah in a military uniform, and he was made a sort of honorary military commander in Hezbollah. Now, fast forward, that was 2008. Fast forward a couple of years to the war that unfolded in Syria. Samir Khazar had actually become, from merely a symbol, he had become a military asset again, and he was an important go-between Hezbollah and other communities. He was actually not a Shia Muslim. He's a Druze. He's secular. He's a secular Arab nationalist. And so he was someone who was able to recruit people from Arab nationalist and Druze communities to fight on Hezbollah's side. And by the time of his death this weekend, he was actually in charge of building a Druze pro-government, pro-Hezbollah militia in an area of southern Syria around a city called Sweida. And he was also in charge of military operations in the Golan Heights on the Syrian side. Now, his profile had always been kept pretty high. And it's interesting that on this front, on this sort of very sensitive front in the Golan Heights, which, as one can imagine, is the one that Israel pays the most attention to, Hezbollah has dispatched highly polarizing symbolic commanders. The previous commander was Jihad Muhniya, who you might remember the name of Imad Muhniya, the actual supreme military commander of Hezbollah for many decades, who was killed in another Israeli assassination. Well, so his son, Jihad, who's in his early 20s, had been dispatched to run the Golan Front. Israel killed him in a strike. And then he was replaced with Samir Khazar, this equally polarizing figure who was killed, I guess, early this morning, our time.
And again, I'm speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and is a fellow at the Century Foundation. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his latest is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. So, given that this is a high-ranking official and, of course, probably one of the most hated people in Israel, spent 30 years in jail there, was traded for the bodies of Israeli soldiers, and then was just killed just outside of Damascus. And so how is this going to affect the calculus with Hezbollah itself, which, of course, is Iranian-backed? I assume that in these negotiations that took place at the UN National Security Council, where the Russians and the Americans seem to have come together, Kerry and Lavrov seem to have worked out the outlines of a peace deal, that would have to involve Iran. And would this be throwing a spanner in the works?
I don't think so. I mean, this is, I think, much symbolic hay will be made out of this. He's not that important militarily, right? He's a symbol, as we just discussed. He's not a crucial military commander. Now they've lost, Hezbollah and Iran as well, have lost much more important fighters on the battlefield in Syria, people who were actually of strategic importance in the military command. So I don't think this is going to affect that process one way or another. And when you sort of pull back and look at the prospects of that deal, I assume that Hezbollah will be satisfied with any deal that is satisfactory to Damascus and Iran. So if Iran and Damascus are satisfied, one of their core requirements is going to be a deal that preserves Hezbollah's ability to import arms through Syria. That's one of the sort of pillars of the Assad regime. So I assume that they will resist any kind of deal that somehow requires Iran to give up Hezbollah in exchange for keeping Assad. I think that will be a non-starter. And then if the sort of improbable diplomatic breakthrough leads to something, a regime survival deal is going to also be a Hezbollah, not just a Hezbollah survival deal, but a deal that preserves Hezbollah's freedom to operate with full support from Damascus.
Well, there's no question that the fate of Assad featured quite heavily in the debate last night between the Democratic presidential candidates, and Bernie Sanders was sort of suggesting that the regime change has been a catastrophe. Of course, Hillary voted for the Iraq War and was involved in the toppling of Gaddafi in Libya. And it's worth noting that the toppling of Gaddafi, in many ways, was the inspiration, if you will, for the uprising in Syria itself against Assad, which was initially just people spontaneously taken to the streets. And then, of course, Assad, rather than negotiate with his people, just gunned them down and started this civil war. Go ahead.
And Ian, this raises actually a critical question, because there's been a lot of conversation in Western diplomatic circles, and frankly here as well, on this question that I think is somewhat misleadingly framed as a question of regime change. We talk a lot about fears of instability or some kind of continuity of the state if Assad was to be replaced, and a lot, again, of mileage from both sides, frankly, of the debate over will Syria become another failed state? Will it become another Libya? Can you replace Assad but preserve intact the institutions of Syria? And I think we need a little bit of a corrective here, because in truth, there isn't so much of a Syrian state as its supporters would claim, and even as Assad's opponents assume when they talk about preserving the state while getting rid of Assad. I'm not sure there's that much of a state. I mean, the way Syria operates, you've got something like 18 intelligence agencies that are directly controlled by the Assad family, and they dominate every single thing. The rest of the so-called national institutions, things like the army, the military, the ministries, the health ministry, and so on, are not really independent functioning bodies. It's not like Egypt, where no matter how corrupt and despotic and messed up a state Egypt is, there really is a state, right? If you eliminate, if you remove the president and the top 10 people under him, there is such a thing as the institutions of state that will keep on ticking. In Syria, I'm not sure that's the case, and that's something that is a huge problem, actually, because the Assad dynasty over two presidents for life has sort of successfully gutted Syria's ability to function without them, and that's sort of Assad's final power play, is to say, hey, there really is no such thing as a Syrian state. There is my family-run enterprises, some call them mafias, and without me, those things really will fracture and collapse. And there's almost no ability. There's no ability even to replace him with another Alawite strongman. And that is, in my view, one of the biggest obstacles to finding a resolution to this war.
Well, it's hard to shed a tear for Assad under those circumstances, surely. If this is just a mafia-run family estate, and it has been all along, it sounds like it'd be a blessing to get rid of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think what certainly people like myself would like to see is something better, right? I would like to see a Syria that reflects the aspirations not of all of the citizens, but of a sort of highest-minded citizens. And it's really hard to figure out how you get from here to there, because on the Assad side, you have this sort of constellation of mafias. And on the other side, on the rebel and ISIS and Nusra side, you have a bunch of largely, not entirely, you have dominating it are a bunch of miniature warlords, some of them who are jihadists, some of them who are less religious, and none of them offer a model for a pluralistic, more modern Syria, the better Syria that would tap into its really proud culture and heritage and great human capital. And until such a movement or figure emerges or sort of forced into being by outside sponsors, we're going to be stuck in this kind of bad trade-off. And one glimmer of hope, perversely, is Russia. Unlike Iran, Iran is actually quite happy to operate in collapsing or fragmented environments like Iraq, contemporary Iraq, or like the contemporary battlefield in Syria. They like that kind of flux. But Russia is a traditional power, and it wants there to be such a thing as a Syrian state. They want something that transcends a single strongman. They actually prefer the continuity that would come with having a real military that is professional and can have military-to-military contact and so on. And that is an interest that they share with the Americans. And so I'm not sure it makes it possible, but it certainly makes it more plausible if you have these two world powers sharing a common interest in forcing back into being something that lots of Syrians want as well. How they get that, how they build that, and then force it into being as an alternative to Assad, I'm not sure I see a practical blueprint, but it's something that I think a lot of those late-night conversations around the diplomatic process are about this very question.
Well, the Russians just bombed Idlib and apparently killed a lot of civilians. And my understanding is that the Syrian people just loathe the Russians because they feel that they're one, prolonging the war, and two, they're propping up Assad, who would otherwise have fallen but for Russia and Iran's help. So that's going to be one wonders what the Russians are going to end up with. Clearly,
well, we have to remember there are actually plenty of Syrians who like Assad and plenty of Syrians who are applauding the Russian intervention. They might not be a majority, but they probably are something close to a third or a half of the population.
So up to a half of the population? Because there's so many of the people have fled,
I would say a third to a half of the population reluctantly or passionately, depending on their degree of support, back the regime. And that's why this war has gone on so long. There's a sizable bunch of the Sunni community that has taken sides with the regime or chosen to sit out the conflict. And that is a reflection of, in my view, their sense that there isn't a viable alternative yet, because it's hard to imagine that given the choice, other than those who are directly enriched by the regime or those who think they'll be killed because of their ethnicity, that the regime falls. I think most other Syrians would prefer to see something better, but they haven't cast their lot with the uprising, and it's been 5 years, and that tells you something about the regime's appeal. It does have an appeal beyond its sort of kleptocratic base, and that's something we also have to come to terms with as we analyze the prospects for either regime change or conflict resolution.
So would that be the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know, given the nature of and the fanaticism of the Islamic State?
Well, that's part of it, but I think actually another big part is the signal failing of the military leaders of the uprising to reassure non-religious non-Sunnis that they will have an equal share in a future Syria. And this is a big failing because there are lots and lots of secular Sunnis, and then you have all these other ethnic and religious groups, Christians, Shia, Druze, Alawi, and so on. And in practice, what they've seen is a pretty sectarian and bloodthirsty practice on the battlefield by the fighters. And so they do not trust that a quote-unquote liberated Syria or a post-Assad Syria would be a place where they could be equal citizens. And I think they actually have good reason to believe that. It's not simply it's a regime propaganda line that also happens to be true. And in my view, it's something that would be actually quite easy if the opposition militias or the anti-government militias really cared about this idea. they could quite, and some of the small ones do this, they could quite simply recruit into symbolic positions members of minority groups and say, look, we have some company commanders that are Christian, we have battle sergeants that are Alawi, and we believe that in future Syria, it doesn't matter what ethnicity or religion you have, you'll have equal rights. And they don't even have to prove that, they just have to say it. And the fact that so few of them do is a real alarming problem, and I think that, more than anything else, has kept a great deal of Syrians who don't like the regime from joining in some way with its opposition.
Well, Thanasi Kambaras, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Ian.
Thank you very much. And again, I've been speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambaras, who writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe. He's a contributor to foreign policy and is a fellow at the Century Foundation. And his books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why the DNC is trying to make sure as few Americans as possible watch the Democratic presidential debates. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who has worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Lawrence.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's good to be with you.
And John, it looks as though, and it seems counterintuitive, but it looks as though the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, headed by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, is trying to make sure as few Americans as possible watch the Democratic debates, while the Republican debates are getting record ratings. So I know this is a complaint from both Bernie Sanders people and Martin O'Malley's people, but even David Axelrod sort of suggested the other day that that the DNC is putting their finger on the scale in tilting towards Hillary. What is the thinking if this is true? Because frankly, both Hillary and Bernie Sanders are both very good debaters, and the programs are worth watching. Although, you know, they put them on Saturday night up against Dallas Cowboys versus the New York Jets. They don't offer them up to public radio. We'd play the debates, but DNC's given exclusive contract with Westwood One Radio, so they don't get much play in radio. And you just, I'm actually quite mystified about what their strategy is here.
The timing and the conditions of these debates, of course, are negotiated between the Democratic National Committee and the campaigns. I'm not privy to what those negotiations are, and I don't know to what extent either Mrs. Clinton or other candidates put firm restrictions on the timing or the procedures of the debates. But everybody agrees to them. In fact, when they start talking over each other, you'll hear the moderators always say, these are the rules that you agreed to. So there, it may be that the Clinton campaign has only agreed to certain times or that the DNC only offered certain times. But we don't know that that's, I certainly don't know that that's the case. The real bottom line, I think, is that when comparing the current Democratic debates to the ongoing Republican debates, they're really They're occurring on two different spheres. The Republican debate is one amongst a number of candidates where the outcome is quite unknown, where many of the candidates are still trying to introduce themselves to the electorate. And particularly now, I think, are important because Donald Trump has assumed and maintained such a significant lead that the other candidates are desperate to, for any of the free time that they can be provided in these debates for establishing their own purpose of for running and their own perspective. Whereas on the Democratic side, I think there's a general recognition that the likely outcome of this nomination is pretty clear and has been for a very long time. And that rather than having expansive exposure by multiple candidates, the goal to some extent is to reduce your exposure, to minimize the opportunity for mistakes, to not give the press or opponents or people in social media the opportunity to latch onto one phrase or one mistake and exploit it as a weakness. So it really it may well be that Mrs. Clinton, as a extreme front runner in the case of the Democratic nomination, has put tight constraints on what types of debates she would agree to participate in. But overall, from the standpoint of the party, you don't want to do something which is going to increase the likelihood of the kinds of missteps that could cost you, if not in the primary process, then down the road. So I think that's a long answer that can get boiled down to. It seems to me likely to be a strategic decision to minimize the profile for damage but still provide an opportunity for the other candidates to have their voices heard.
And again, I'm speaking with John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. So just before, of course, the debate, there was this moment of frenzy on cable news about Bernie Sanders' campaign getting access to proprietary information about Hillary's campaign, which was afforded them by a glitch in the vendor that the DNC had hired. And apparently this wasn't the first time this had happened. So, again, there's some question of competence. I guess both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, I felt, rather deftly put that whole story to bed. But it still does raise some questions, does it not?
Senator Sanders himself yesterday said that this kind of a breach had occurred once before, and that he had determined that at that time his staff had not looked at the material that had become available. When this occurred a second time, there were several people apparently who did look at the information, and he judged that to be serious enough that he dismissed at least one person from his campaign and perhaps more. I did note last night a suggestion that he made that perhaps the exact same situation had occurred with Senator Clinton and perhaps her staff had viewed some of his material. I thought that was a little bit of a low blow in that it was pure speculation. But I think the main point here is that there's no real accusation that's been made against the Clinton campaign to the extent to which there's an issue here. There's an issue with the Sanders campaign gaining access to and using, or at least viewing, some material, and the DNC with their vendor and the security systems. So to some extent, but for that insinuation by Senator Sanders, there really isn't any indication that Mrs. Clinton has been anything but a victim, if you will, and I'm not pulling out my handkerchief over this. I think this is part of the problem that you run into with technology, and I don't think that these kinds of breaches are particularly new. They occur in systems that are incredibly complex, are designed to be virtually unbreachable. Think of the recent OPM, Office of Personnel Management, which I think the Chinese are accused of breaching millions of records. So I guess there is a question here about the vendors, but with respect to the culpability of any of the campaigns, even the Sanders campaign, we don't really know that this information was used in any kind of an insidious way. So I tend to think it's probably, ultimately, it probably breaks down to much ado about nothing. I think the Sanders people scrambled pretty impressively to counter the damage that was done to what their own person had done by making these charges against the DNC and the DNC's issue of shutting down their access to their own material. But I really think that was largely a counter move. And in any event, in the long history of campaign 2016, I don't think this will rate much more than a footnote.
So you don't think that the Sanders campaign had a point when they said, you know, the DNC had unilaterally cut them off? They just literally cut their own access to their own material, which is the sort of an election's lifeline, the way that they put it. And it seemed that they were being punished, you know, almost like Debbie Wasserman Schultz was the school mom scolding them. And that by threatening a lawsuit, according to the Sanders campaign head, that the DNC relented because they didn't want the discovery process to reveal possible collusions between the DNC and Hillary Clinton's campaign.
I really think that's a lot of speculation. I mean, that may be 100% true, but it's just as possible that none of that is true. In terms of collusion, my guess is that that both sides were, both sides being the DNC and Senator Sanders, were maneuvering here to put most of the responsibility on the other's doorstep. That the DNC, as I understand the situation, felt that the access to the system was, there obviously had been a problem with it, and they needed to ensure that however that access had been gained, that it would not continue, and they were looking to have negotiations with the Sanders campaign to ensure that whatever mechanism was used to gain that unauthorized access to Clinton campaign files was not going to remain open to them, and that for whatever reason, the Sanders campaign wasn't responding satisfactorily. I think they being the DNC, upped the ante to seek that resolution by closing down the Sanders campaign's access. I think the Sanders campaign did what one would expect to do in these circumstances, which was to up the ante against the DNC to force them to respond more rapidly. And I think both of those actions, which in my view fall well within the realm of expected responses, are going to be can be chalked up to protecting your interests and having the desired result, which was to expedite a resolution. Look at it from the other end. If the DNC discovered that Senator Sanders' staff was accessing confidential information through a flaw in the DNC system and didn't do anything about it, imagine the charge that the Clinton campaign could make. That why wasn't punitive action taken? Why wasn't access cut off? I mean, it could just as easily have gone the other way, and in some respects could have been more justifiable, because the breach that occurred was neutral, but the Sanders campaign's utilization of that breach was purposeful. So it may well be that it's just one of these damned if you do, damned if you don't. But the bottom line really is both Sanders and the DNC brought out the big guns, and the big guns had the desired effect, which is they resolved the situation without a lawsuit and with very minimum cutoff of access to their own information. So, again, I think these sorts of things are inevitable when we're dealing with this kind of very sophisticated technology, particularly when you do have the information residing within a third party that is not within the Sanders campaign or the Clinton campaign, but rather within a third party. And I would just hope and expect that the DNC is and will continue to not try to put its finger on the scale one way or the other. It would really be short-sighted and unnecessary. If this were a campaign that people thought had a very different outcome, I would say I would be a lot more alarmed here about the possibility that that's what was happening. But I really can't imagine that anybody at the DNC is prepared to risk the kind of public disapproval or legal action given the nature of this race.
Well, just in the last minute then, John Lawrence, back to the debate itself, what was your reaction? I thought that obviously most people think that Hillary Clinton did very well. I thought Bernie Sanders did very well. Martin O'Malley irritated me. I kept wondering, why are you there? Because he kept sort of pointing to himself as a professional politician. I guess that's what they do. What was your take on it?
I thought everybody did a good job, and I actually thought that O'Malley, I liked O'Malley, although the number of the reviews that I've seen today were pretty negative. O'Malley, unlike the other two, obviously has to sell himself in a much more aggressive way because he's not that well known. But I would say this, that because he's had this experience as a chief executive, both in Baltimore and in Maryland, and you notice that Bernie Sanders brought out his own mayoralty of Burlington, Vermont, to show that he was also had executive experience. But because he has that experience, O'Malley, of 16 years as a chief executive, he is able, when you raise these questions about the court system or about the education system or about the budgeting or a number of these other policies, his innovations as a governor, whether it's in the area of gun policy or it's in the area of marriage equality, of saying, look, this is what I did and I was ahead of the curve and we made it work. And it sounds self-promotional, but I mean, after all, we are talking about a presidential campaign. If you're not prepared to tout your own achievements, who is? I think O'Malley's problem is that he's not taken seriously and understandably, but I think, if you remove those other two people from the race and it was a race among people of O'Malley's generation, I don't mean necessarily his age, but that level of expertise in politics, he is a former mayor and a former governor in a strong Democratic state and with a good record on issues that Democrats really care about, women's issues, gay issues, gun issues. I think he'd be a credible candidate. This year, I don't think he is. I don't think he's a bad candidate, but he's not a credible one. Sanders, I think, comes across as still to me as abrasive. And regardless of whether I agree with him or I don't agree with him, it's just there's little that I see in his public performances in these debates that persuades me of his ability to reach beyond his base, either in terms of more of the Democrats, but even in terms of independence. And that's critical in winning a race. I think he's got a very hard edge. He's got a very strong ideological point of view and a very strong focus on economic equity. And I think most, for what he says, most Democrats agree with him, but I don't think they see him as the kind of a person who can put together the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle to win a national campaign, which leaves us with Clinton, who did, I think, pretty much what she needs to do. She demonstrated, if not absolute fealty to liberal Democratic positions on some key issues like the Middle East and some military issues, then certainly she's well within the sphere of the Democratic Party, I think she showed a level of competence on national security and foreign policy issues, which is going to be very critical. I mean, it's also a liability for her because she's going to have to defend a record as Secretary of State. But the bottom line is this. When you're running 2-1 ahead, it's your race to lose. And all the focus is going to be on whether or not you messed up, whether or not anybody was able to raise an issue that really damages your credibility or your presentability. And that doesn't happen. And it's more than that. I mean, she I think, continues to demonstrate a level of sophistication and knowledgeability as a candidate, which is very, very difficult to undo. I think the other thing that I just would mention, Ian, is it's interesting to me, a number of people in the last week with whom I've been talking, as this Republican story keeps getting murkier and murkier as to where that nomination goes and what ultimately happens, a number of people have told me of conversations with pretty establishment Republicans at fundraisers and at political events. And the way one person put it to me is they were surprised by the fact that when the husbands went away to the bar, the women all said, "I'm voting for Hillary Clinton, but I'm not going to tell my husband." And I think that's a piece.
It's true, you know, and I'm hearing similarly from very conservative traditional Republicans that they're going to hold their nose and vote for Hillary because they're so upset with what's happening. John, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much, Ian, and happy holidays to you.
To you, too. And again, I've been speaking with John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why the self-declared Islamic State has terrified the American people and dominated our political discourse. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Brenner, who's a professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh and a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributor to research and consulting projects on the Euro-American security and economic issues. He's a consultant to the United States Department of Defense and State and is the author of numerous books, including most recently Towards a More Independent Europe. And his latest article at the Huffington Post is Getting Real, an ISIL Strategy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Brenner.
Good to be with you.
And Michael, the debate last night between the Democratic presidential candidates was largely dominated by foreign policy, for the want of a better description, most of which was focused on defeating the Islamic State or ISIL. There were some arguments, obviously, between different approaches offered by Senator Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. But my sense is that I don't understand why the American people are terrified of a few thousand Mad Max-like desert marauders in pickup trucks waving black flags. Why have they reached a point where they've scared the life out of the American people, dominated our political discourse, and have our politicians foaming at the mouth?
Well, I think there are really sort of two questions here. One is, does the evolution of ISIS, and it's taking sort of center stage in the Middle East constitute something that is really new in terms of threats to the United States, terrorists generally, and third, to political stability, to whatever measure it has existed in the Middle East. The other question is, of course, the extremity of the reaction in the United States. The reaction in the United States, of course, is only indirectly related to ISIL per se, insofar as the only incidents that have occurred on American soil were really undertaken by persons resident in the United States, in fact, citizens of the United States, with the exception of this Pakistani sort of woman, Malik in San Bernardino. So what one is suggesting there is that somehow ISIL, by its very existence, motivates, sort of inspires, these people. ISIL itself had some kind of indirect connection to the Paris acts of terrorism, but even there, the terrorism acts themselves were carried out by French citizens. So there's a mixing of the two, which is to a considerable extent arbitrary and confected, but the net effect, of course, is to sort of intensify the emotional reaction and to deepen the fear that somehow there is this great malevolent force out there, which is sort of threatening the safety and security of people everywhere here in the United States and in Western Europe as well.
Well, clearly, Hillary Clinton's criticism, or at least her proposals that she put forth to defeat ISIL, indicated to me that she was clearly, in effect, breaking with Obama, implicitly criticizing him for not having done what she's suggesting. What was your impression?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the truth is that the Obama approach is really rooted in a very conventional worldview, which she has shared and is a full participant in. Let's make a couple of things sort of clear. First, the notion that there was a great opportunity that was missed to support democratic secular forces in Syria is a complete myth. Everyone who knows anything about Syria, and let me say one of the people I'm in regular contact with, spent 10 years of... He's the French former head of counterterrorism in Paris. Spent 10 years in Syria, is one of the world's leading experts on it, and he finds the whole idea laughable. The opposition from day one was dominated by Islamist forces. There were some members of the sort of Free Syrian Army who were not Islamists, but they were very quickly eclipsed. I think the second fallacy is we did nothing. We now have reports that, in fact, even while President Obama was declaring that there was nothing, that there was little that could be done, that he was reluctant to provide direct material support to any of the so-called opposition elements, the United States, through the CIA, was providing $1 billion in weaponry and other forms of material support. And we've now learned that most of that wound up in the hands of Islamist groups, particularly al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. I mean, this has now been reported. It's a matter of public record, completely ignored by the mainstream media. And, of course, when we recognize these givens of the situation, the so-called differences and debates between not the debate, the so-called differences between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama evaporate. In other words, Obama did what Hillary Clinton says he should have done, and it was a complete fiasco. It not only failed, but it strengthened al-Qaeda in Syria.
Well, Michael Brenner, then, given the situation now, we were just early in the program, we went to Beirut and talked to an expert on Hezbollah to talk about the assassination of by the Israelis of this notorious militant. He was just saying, Thanasi Kambanis was just saying that, you can't underestimate that there is considerable support for Assad in the country, even from secular and even from Sunni quarters. So, I know a third of the population has left or internally displaced. Is this agony ever going to be resolved? The UN Security Council had indicated that Kerry and Lavrov have the outlines of some kind of a deal.
Well, let's there's been a lot of misrepresentation here. I mean, Assad is not a very pleasant person, and the regime which he really inherited from his father is quite a nasty one. But it is true that it is a secular regime, just as Saddam's in Iraq was avowedly secular, and that it has not discriminated against very substantial minorities in Syria. The percentage of Syrians who are Christian, Druze, the Alawites minority, which he represents, and others, shielded under, in effect, the umbrella of this dictatorship. And while many of them were not entirely happy with some of the things he'd done, the notion that there has been a sort of a mass cross-the-board rejection of Assad and a willingness to accept alternatives, whatever it might be, is simply not factually correct. And now that, in effect, the two choices are a continuation of, well, or an extension with amendment of the current government, with or without Assad personally, on the one hand, or in Islamist government, be it ISIL or be it al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, then there's every reason to believe that there's a substantial majority, both within the country and among exiles, who would opt for the former. As for minorities, they aren't even sure they would physically survive under an ISIL government. And much of what the United States has been doing, in fact, by supporting directly and indirectly Islamic forces, is putting their future lives in jeopardy. Their salvation, frankly, is really in the hands of Vladimir Putin.
Well, that gets to an interesting question, though, that Putin wants, obviously, he wants a stable government there. He said it many times, and obviously he wants to keep his bases, and he wants to have people that he can deal with. But my understanding, particularly from our first guest here today, is that it's difficult to describe the Assad as a government. It's more like a family mafia that has the Muhabarat basically keeping the whole thing together. So if you get rid of where they keep saying, well, we'll transition away from Assad, What is there to build upon apart from this family mafia?
Well, we talk about a state or regime. We have to differentiate between a ruling group who sets the direction, fixes policies, etc., and the entire apparatus of the state, which involves everything from tax collection, revenues, garbage collection, and also security. We discovered in Iraq what happens when you simply topple not just a leader, but you uproot an entire regime, when in our ignorance and frankly stupidity, forced out of the government everyone who belonged to the Ba'ath Party, which was a substantial fraction of the population. And so you don't want to do that in Syria. Now, you don't want to, I think ideally, you don't want to maintain the current leadership at the top. But that's to be, you know, the alternative to that is to be determined by a very complex interplay among various political forces in Syria, but would not necessarily and should not entail the uprooting of the Syrian state. Now, of course, the trickiest element in those situations are the security forces, by which I mean not really the army as much as the secrets, you know, the as you mentioned, the intelligence agencies, the interior ministry, et cetera. And that would be a challenge for the future. Now, the big problem beyond that, if you just give me another moment on this, is that there is no evidence that the two most powerful opposition forces, which is al-Nusra and their associate Islamic coalition partners, or ISIL, are willing to participate in anything like a newly constituted government of national unity, or whatever you might call it. And the agreement of the UN is an agreement among external parties, not internal parties. So while it might sort of facilitate things down the, you know, down the road, at the moment, it really does not represent this sort of kernel of a solution or a resolution.
Well, Michael Brenner, I thank you very much for joining us. It's obviously something we have to stay in touch with. You
are, well, let's speak again, and then we can talk about the bad news.
I don't mean to laugh. It's a tragic situation, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Brenner, who's a professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and a contributor to research and consulting projects on Euro-American security and economic issues. He's a consultant to the United States Departments of Defense and State, and he's the author of numerous books, including most recently Towards a More Independent Europe. And his latest article at the Huffington Post is Getting Real, an ISIL Strategy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.